Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. Jim is up in New York City doing some work for CNN, so he joins us by phone today. And Jim, we thought last week was off to a crazy start on a Monday. This week is making sure that it's a close competition, wouldn't you say?
It's accelerating. There is no such thing as a slow news week anymore. And there is kind of this vague sense of, what does the world have for us today, Greg?
Well, here's what the world has for the Three Martini Lunch podcast today. Let's start with our good martini. Keith Ellison is the deputy chairman of the Democratic National Committee, vice chairman technically, but he's the number two guy at the DNC. And, of course, he is out there trying to rally the troops, rally volunteers for the 2018 midterms, which so far are looking pretty favorable for Democrats. On Friday, he gave a speech at a progressive training session, whatever that is, and said this about why Democrats have to win elections. Take a listen.
Did you know that in Missouri and in Texas and maybe other places, maternal mortality has risen? Women are dying because we are losing elections. We don't have the right to lose a damn election. We have to win.
Jim, it's one thing to be upset about the fact that mortality rates for mothers are rising in certain states, but to link it inextricably to Democrats losing elections is a bit of a stretch. As The Hill points out, places like Missouri are seeing rising rates because they've got a really high rate of obesity and smoking. So that might have something to do with it more than elections. But this is our good martini because already the Democrats are playing, you have to vote for us or you're all going to die card. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm reminded of Remy, who does these funny music videos over for Reason magazine, did a very good one entitled People Will Die, which he looked at the rhetoric of the Elizabeth Warren and a couple other examples and said, basically pointed out that every single potential item that comes down the line, every major issue, Democrats insisting that because of Republican views, people will die. And he goes through all the different ideas that you could propose, double seat belts, mandatory safety helmets for anyone walking down the street, all the different things you could do that absolutely could be a legislative priority because people will die. The other thing that kind of comes to mind here, though, is that you would not expect Democrats to be in this state of rhetoric for motivation. You would think that the Trump administration would be giving them enough material. I think quite a few folks would probably agree that the Trump administration is giving them enough material. So it is kind of strange to see them hitting this. It also is worth noting that we've seen more donations drifting towards the candidates themselves. Tom Steyer with his particular, I would argue, hard left, but other folks, his effort for impeachment and things like that. Maybe it's tough for the DNC to stand out anymore. The people kind of forget that the National Party Committee is there. They had their issues in the 2016 campaign. People believe in that they were in the tank for Hillary and holding off Bernie Sanders. Maybe Ellison feels like he's got to take a tone like this. I just don't know if I think this is the one that's going to work. It does seem kind of desperate and ringing the alarm bell very early in the cycle. And as you point out, there's a whole bunch of other facts. It reminds me of John Edwards contending back in the 2004 campaign that if you vote for John Kerry, Christopher Reeve will rise and walk. Because apparently John Kerry, I guess he loosely when later pressed on it, said that you supported stem cell research, and that was because of that. It was going to make all these great medical breakthroughs and all that kind of stuff. Oh, by the way, Bush, we'd eventually end up pulling stem cell research through umbilical cord fluid and things like that, and we ended up having the kinds of developments that people wanted to see through that. But again, it was just kind of the example of how once you're on the campaign trail, you will promise anything and everything, including miracles, if they vote for your guy. It's a bad habit in politics, but I guess we've become kind of unsurprised to see the likes of Ellison doing this again.
I know. We got 6.5 months to go, though. You'd think they'd be talking about Democrats having a better way. I think that wasn't that their slogan last year for a while.
That's why they're not talking about it, Greg.
at least claiming you have better ideas and just don't vote for them or you're all going to die. That doesn't usually work too well. But like you said, perhaps they've already gotten enough ammunition from the Trump administration to do well in the midterms. We'll find out. But let's move on to perhaps another reason why the Democrats might do well in the midterm elections. This is also from The Hill. The chairman of the Senate Budget Committee is floating the idea of getting rid of the budget panel altogether, according to Republican sources. Senate Budget Committee Chairman Mike Enzi of Wyoming has noted that mounting deficits are making it much tougher to pass a spending blueprint. Enzi's seemingly radical suggestion comes as a special bipartisan committee prepares to hold its first hearing on reforming the budgetary process, which Speaker Paul Ryan, a former House Budget Committee chairman this weekend, called irreparably broken. Enzi said in 2016 he would be open to scrapping the budget committee as part of a larger effort to reform the congressional spending process. Oh, it gets worse. Listen to this. Congress has missed the requirement set out by the Congressional Budget Act to pass a concurrent budget resolution by April 15th, and GOP lawmakers say they do not expect to pass a budget before the end of this election year. GOP leaders didn't make much of an effort to pass one because it was clear right away that it would have been difficult, Jim, to muster 51 votes in the Senate for an unpopular 10-year spending plan. So we're just not going to do it because it's tough.
This is a triple bad martini, Greg. It's bad that they are just openly stating, yeah, we're just not going to pass the budget this year. It's not quite the Twitter account, you had one job, Congress, but this was one of your big jobs, one of your top priorities. I'd say you can safely argue that the failure to really get any handle on spending, and even not just like in terms of levels of spending, but on just the basic process of appropriations and going through, setting the budget and appropriations are supposed to be two separate processes. The budget is supposed to kind of set the priorities. This is how much we want to spend. These are what we think is most important. And then the appropriations process is separately supposed to actually allocate the funds. That hasn't really happened that way. We keep having these lumped into this giant omnibuses. Nobody knows what's in it. They get 24 to 48 hours to review what the actual legislation is. Nobody, you know, you always find stuff stuck in the last time. I can't figure out which aspect of this, though, is really the worst part of the bad martini, Greg. Is it that they're contemplating giving up entirely, or that you and I can't really muster a strong argument of, oh, how could you do that? Because they really haven't had much of a budget process the last few years anyway.
Yeah, it's pretty ugly either way. But I think, please reelect us. We're going to not even try anymore is probably not the best campaign slogan.
Republicans 2018. We're not going to fool you anymore. We've stopped trying. Isn't it time you stop trying too?
Oh, man. All right. Let's get on to the crazy martini. But before we do, we're going to briefly touch on something after the crazy martini. So while you're listening to the crazy martini, Google sketch suspect Stormy Daniels, something like that. And you'll be ready for it in a couple minutes when we get to it. But let's get to our crazy martini yesterday, Jim, because yesterday in federal court with Stormy Daniels in attendance, I might add, Michael Cohen and his attorneys were before Judge Kimba Wood. They were challenging the FBI raid, and there was arguments on a number of different things. But at one point, the judge in the case, Judge Wood, ordered Michael Cohen's attorney to reveal who the third mystery client was that Cohen had been working with. We know that he represents President Trump. We also know that he represents a guy who used to be, until very recently, a finance officer at the RNC who Cohen helped to pay off a Playboy playmate or bunny or something like that for an extramarital affair that they were engaged in. And so yesterday, the judge ordered the attorneys to reveal the third name and shocked quite a few people to find out that it was Fox News personality Sean Hannity. So as a result of that, and given the types of issues Michael Cohen has helped his other clients deal with, social media was running pretty wild with what Sean Hannity might have needed Michael Cohen's assistance with. A couple different clips here. First, here's Sean Hannity explaining that this was no big deal on his Fox show last night.
Let me set the record straight. Here's the truth. Michael Cohen never represented me in any legal matter. I never retained his services. I never received an invoice. I never paid Michael Cohen for legal fees. I did have occasional brief conversations with Michael Cohen. He's a great attorney, about legal questions I had, or I was looking for input and perspective. My discussions with Michael Cohen never rose to any level that I needed to tell anyone that I was asking him questions. And to be absolutely clear, they never involved any matter, sorry to disappoint so many, matter between me or third party, a third group at all.
So, Jim, I think there's a lot we could potentially counter there, especially his conclusion that he didn't have to tell anybody about this relationship while he talked about Cohen, and especially the raid that occurred last week. But Alan Dershowitz did it for him. This happened shortly into his program.
Well, first of all, Sean, I do want to say that I really think that you should have disclosed your relationship with Cohen when you talked about him on this show. You could have said just that you had asked him for advice or whatever. But I think it would have been much, much better had you disclosed that relationship. You were in a difficult situation,
obviously. If you
understand
the nature of it, Professor, I'm going to deal with this later in the show.
No, I understand.
It was minimal. I put out a statement about it.
You should have said that. And that would have been fair to say that it was minimal.
That's fine. You were in
a tough position because, A, you had to talk about Cohen, and, B, you didn't want the fact that you had spoken to him to be revealed. And you had the right, by the way, not to have your identity
I have the
revealed.
Right to privacy.
Right.
But,
you know, it's a complex situation when you're speaking to millions of people.
Professor, it was such a minor relationship in terms
of...
You should have said that. So that's one of the two big takeaways here, I think, Jim. One is that it's pretty clear Hannity has gotten himself deeply entangled into Trump world, which is probably never a good thing. And secondly, he obviously had a responsibility, even if it was fairly minor, to disclose this to his viewers and listeners. And good for Dershowitz for calling him out on it.
Yeah, this is a journalistic scandal. It's not really a legal scandal, particularly if Hannity is characterizing it accurately. In fact, it's a little bit strange that Cohen would list Hannity as one of his clients. Probably what's at stake here is that, as we know, the FBI raided Cohen's offices, home, and hotel room, took a bunch of records, and now Cohen is making the argument that these things are covered, that some of those documents are covered by attorney-client privilege. And it's one of those things where even if the contention is that whatever he's dealing with President Trump is not covered by attorney-client privilege because of the criminal fraud statute, that, you know, Cohen's argument is, well, wait, you also took some records that are related to other clients who I assume are not under investigation by the DOJ, and the documents would thus still be covered by attorney-client privilege. Now, the thing is that based on what Hannity and Cohen are describing, I'd be surprised if there was really that much paperwork involved. Hannity really makes it sound like it's a couple of very casual conversations. He says he never paid for this. And by the way, just you don't have to pay for attorney-client privilege. Otherwise, you wouldn't have it in all those pro bono cases. But what's more, you know, attorney-client privilege covers the communications and documents and things like that related to seeking legal advice and dealing with that particular legal issue, meaning that if Sean Hannity and Cohen exchange emails about the Yankees or the weather or, hey, what have you heard about Trump or something like that, that may not be covered by attorney-client privilege. They've defined it fairly narrowly because it is against the you know, public disclosure and truth and things like that. So it's really not clear that this would be covered by this. Look, if you're Sean Hannity and you've had Cohen do any legal work for you, you probably should disclose that. Apparently, way back in around the inauguration, Hannity had Cohen on his program, and he described him as a longtime friend. That may sort of cover it, but if you're going to be, you know, fuming and pounding the table about how terrible it is that the FBI raided Cohen's office, you probably should mention that you've had Cohen doing some legal work for you. This is not how you want this sort of thing to get disclosed. I know Hannity says he's got a right to privacy, but, you know, in the world of journalism, you give up at least a little bit of that right to privacy if you end up writing about or covering or discussing someone that you have a personal connection to. And there's, you know, not exactly clearly delineated lines. Different places will have different different rules on this. But most people would assume that on Fox News, if you're going to be, you know, discussing your person, one of your lawyers, that you would at least acknowledge that at some point during the segment that, you know, and Hannity has left the things up here. One of the great other ironies, of course, is that Cohen had a reasonably good day in terms of his arguments in front of Judge Kimball Wood. She may appoint a special master to kind of go through all the documents and figure out which ones are covered by attorney-client privilege and which ones aren't. Prosecutors do not have immediate access for them. So there is some good news in there for Cohen. But Hannity's got some egg on his face today. The only thing I can think of, Greg, as sort of as a quasi-defense of this is that I think everybody who tunes into Hannity, Greg, they know what they're getting. I mean, you know, you're going to get the pro-Trump version of events, and things that are bad for Trump probably aren't going to be running at the top of the hour on Hannity. So I don't know if you can say, as a lot of people put it, wow, I really can't see Hannity as an objective journalist after something like this.
Clearly, they've been watching. Clearly. All right. As our chaser today, if you've done your Googling, today Stormy Daniels and her attorney released the sketch of the person that she claims back in 2011 threatened her allegedly. That'd be, you know, be a shame if your daughter didn't have a mom or something like that, in a parking garage in Las Vegas as she was headed to an exercise class. They released the sketch of the guy that she says threatened her 7 years ago. And Jim, you've had some initial thoughts on this sketch.
Well, okay, so let's see. She unveils a sketch, and Greg, there's no other way to say it. It's New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. And you're probably saying, ah, ha, ha, there goes Jim, the New York Jets fan, assuming, accusing Tom Brady of malevolent, terrible crimes. But no, really, look at the sketch. It pretty much looks like Tom Brady. And the other really weird thing is that the alleged intimidator, the thug, the person who was threatening her, has kind of long hair. And if you look back to 2011, Tom Brady actually had long hair back then. So now people say, Jim, are you genuinely accusing Tom Brady of being a Trump thug and running around attempting to intimidate Stormy Daniels? Maybe. I'd say lock him up, Greg. I'm ready to begin that chance. If that's what it takes to get Tom Brady out of the NFL, that's fine. I say this somewhat tongue-in-cheek. Willem Dafoe is another comparison. For everyone who enjoyed the cinematic classic Team America, World Police, people have said the sketch kind of resembles the lead puppet in that movie. You can draw your own conclusions. The only other thing, which is, again, very unusual about this, and I preface this by saying that if Stormy Daniels was genuinely threatened, that's a terrible thing, and no one should ever go through something like that. But, and I say this knowing that I just compared him to Tom Brady, this is the most strikingly handsome thug anyone has ever run across. This is soap opera male model staring out at you with a fancy watch or cologne style thug. So, maybe standards are very high for grooming in the Trump organization. If you want to be a leg breaker, if you want to be somebody who's hired to intimidate people, things like that, you have to keep up with the very best looking. And we want to have the best looking thugs possible working to intimidate people on behalf of Donald Trump.
It says on there that he was in his 30s to early 40s, which I guess would qualify. However, it says he was 5'9 to 6 feet, and I believe Tom Brady is significantly taller than that, is he not?
Yeah, but again, maybe, I'm not sure Ms. Daniels would necessarily be able to accurately assess the height. I don't know. It all happened very quickly. She remembered the eyes very clearly. This is where it looks most distinctly like him. The real question is, did he attempt to throw something at her during all this, or did he attempt to scramble or something like that? I'm trying to build a case here, Greg.
So you're saying just to be safe, he should probably be detained from September through December.
At least, Greg.
Well, we'll find out where this goes from here. A lot of different tentacles, to say the least. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.